Middle East Studies at Marine Corps University presents Bringing the Military Back In, Civil-Military Relations in Post-Mubarak Egypt by Dr. Stephen A. Cook, Council on Foreign Relations. Stephen Cook is a Hasib Sabah Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's an expert on Arab and Turkish politics as well as U.S. Middle East policy. Dr. Cook is the author of The Struggle for Egypt, From Nasser to Tahrir Square, which won the Washington Institute for Near East Policy's Gold Medal for Best Book on the Middle East in 2012, and Ruling But Not Governing, the Military and Political Development in Egypt, Algeria, and Turkey. Dr. Cook has published widely in a variety of foreign policy journals, opinion magazines, and newspapers. He currently writes the blog From the Potomac to the Euphrates. Prior to joining CFR, Dr. Cook was a research fellow at the Brookings Institute and a SORF research fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Dr. Cook holds a BA in International Studies from Vassar College, an MA in International Relations from Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and both an MA and PhD in Political Science from the University of Pennsylvania. He speaks Arabic and Turkish and reads French. This lecture took place Wednesday, 19 March 2014 at Gray Research Center, Quantico, Virginia.
How this light works. 8 years now, I was always wondering whether it works or not, and it actually does work. General, good to have you here, sir. You know, when you invite people to come to this talk, and I've been here now for close to 8 years, there's a lot of these people you have heard about, and some of these scholars you have read. And you bring him in because of the purpose that it's my, you know, work is Middle East Studies here at Brinkley University to discuss Middle East from various points. We have brought people from very, very diverse background. But there's some who actually I personally read and use in my work quite a bit. And today's speaker, as I just told him, I've never met him in person. This is the very first time we have the pleasure of meeting. I know him from his writings. And I have used his writings, and actually have recommended it to many people among our PME community and beyond. And if you are interested in the civil-military relationship in the Middle East, and not just today we're talking about Egypt, but in that region, Turkey, Egypt, Algeria, I don't think you have a better person to talk with than Dr. Stephen Cook. He really knows this stuff. Dr. Cook is the Hasib Sabah Senior Fellow for the Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's an expert on Arab and Turkish politics as well as U.S. Middle East policy. Dr. Cook is the author of Struggle for Egypt, From Nasser to Tahrir Square, that came out from Oxford University Press in 2011, which won the Washington Institute for Near East Policy Gold Medal for Best Book on the Middle East in 2012. Ed, Ruling But Not Governing, the Military and Politics Development in Egypt, Algeria, and Turkey. That was published by Johns Hopkins. There's only one copy of those in our library. I have it. If you need it, just come to my office. I have kept that book out for now almost 2.5 years, I have to admit. It's indispensable to know that. I really need to believe that. It's out of print, so I'm not actually advertising this book, which is, you can't find it.
I had two, I can sell it to you.
And I'm not going to go more to his biography. He goes to become the place, not just going, doesn't mean that you have to know it. He is very, very current. And while he will be talking today about bringing the military back, the civil military relationship in post-Mubarak Egypt, if you have questions, I think beyond the borders of Egypt and beyond the issue of civil military, I think you have a dynamic speaker. And I'm very thankful that you came to Quantico.
Thank you very much. Please. Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here at Marine Corps University. Special thanks to Professor Amin Tarzi for the wonderful invitation here. And it's true, we had never met before, but we certainly had a meeting of the minds when I arrived a little more than an hour or so ago. Although it wasn't about the Middle East, it was about the New York Yankees, so it was great. We're going to go to the Bronx together and see the Yankees. It's really, I'm really, now I'm really glad I made the trip here because I've met another Yankee fanatic. I feel like I live in a sea of Red Sox fans. And many thanks to Adam Stites for the logistics here. Let me start out my talk by saying that what I'm going to focus on today, and I'm not going to be stuck at this lectern. I might walk around. I noticed there's someone over here who might even see me at the lectern here. I want to focus on the civil-military relations aspect of what's happening in Egypt. There's a lot of questions, a lot of debate in Washington these days about military aid to Egypt. I'm not a guns and trucks kid. In fact, my one experience with guns and trucks was when I actually went to 29 Palms, California, when I was getting my master's degree at SAIS, and the strategic studies geeks ran a staff ride out to 29 Palms, and we went out on the Marine Commandant's airplane, and we got to play Marine for the weekend, which was really, really cool. But I realized that when my father dissuaded me from going to the Naval Academy, it was probably a good thing. And his reason for dissuading me from going to the service was not having any disdain for the military at all. In fact, he was someone who had enormous and deep respect for the military. He just didn't think that I was very good with, and I guess he would know, very good with authority, so he figured I'd probably get thrown out relatively quickly. So I went on to study military history, civil military relations, military sociology, and military politics. When Adam emailed a few weeks ago and asked me what I wanted to title this talk, I said that I wanted to call it Bringing the Military Back In. And there's a specific reason. I wasn't just sitting at my computer and saying, oh, gee, what am I going to call this talk that I have to do at Marine Corps University? I actually thought about this. And I called it Bringing the Military Back In for two important reasons. First, there's a famous volume that every graduate student, every PhD student, and do you have anybody here who are PhD students recently, PhD students, want to be PhD students? I know you want to be PhD students. Within the first 5 minutes of entering school, you'll be handed a copy of an edited volume called Bringing the State Back In. And this was part of an effort of a group of scholars to bring the state back into the study of political science as a unit of analysis. And bizarrely, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and part of the 80s, the state really wasn't a central part of the discipline of political science. When I started doing my dissertation research, which became my book, Ruling But Not Governing, there hadn't been a book written on civil-military relations in the Middle East for the better part of 25 years. And this was my intellectual project in that work, and since then, has been to bring the military back in as a unit of analysis. And lo and behold, whereas many people thought that the military was too hard to study, that it wasn't really a factor in politics, we have the uprisings in the Arab world that begin in late 2010, and militaries are suddenly playing very, very important roles throughout the region, but in particular in Egypt, which is my subject today. So, in ways, the military actually never went away. That's the sneaky part of bringing the military back in. The military actually never went away. And I'll go through why I don't think that the military ever went away and what the military is up to now in Egypt, which is going to have, I think, to broaden the topic, is going to have a profound effect on the trajectory of Egyptian politics and likely to have a profound effect on the trajectory of politics throughout the region, given the important role that Egypt plays throughout the region. But in order to get some analytic traction on this question of the military and politics and the role of civil-military relations in Egypt's future trajectory, I think we need to understand some basic facts about the past of civil-military relations in Egypt. The first basic fact that you need to know about Egypt and civil-military relations is that when Gamal Abdel Nasser and the Free Officers came to power by coup d'etat in July 1952, they had no plan. They had absolutely no plan. The official narrative of the July 1952 coup is something that was manufactured after the coup d'etat, after the Free Officers consolidated their power, about 2 years after they came to power. But really, the reason why they moved at the time that they moved was because they were going to be arrested. And they put into plan this coup that they had been planning but weren't yet ready to execute. The second basic fact that you need to know about civil-military relations in Egypt is that after the schism, although it was welcomed by virtually every political group and faction in Egypt at the time, all of those groups, just like today, had very, very different views about the future Egypt, the future direction of Egyptian politics. And very, very quickly, after the Free Officers came to power, they ran into the buzzsaw of these very different views and the buzzsaw of very difficult civilian politics in Egypt. One of the official reasons, part of the official narrative for the coup, was the kind of destabilized political arena as a result of very difficult civilian politics at the time. That happens to be one aspect of the official regime narrative that is true about the coup d'etat. In response to the difficulties that the Free Officers encountered once they took power, they sought to resolve their domestic political troubles by discovering a set of institutions that would resolve these problems for them. These institutions were inherently authoritarian. And these institutions came to reflect their interests and the interests of their civilian allies. In this way, the 1950s in Egypt is really no different from the 1960s in Egypt, the 1970s in Egypt, the 1980s in Egypt, the 1990s in Egypt, the first decade of this century, and what I think will unfold in Egypt going forward. Egypt's really no different from any other country where those in power get to determine the institutions of state. When I talk about institutions, I'm not talking about places with offices and phones and water fountains and things like that. I always kid my friends at the Brookings Institution that their organization is misnamed. It's actually the Brookings Institute, not institution. When I talk about institutions, I'm talking about rules, I'm talking about laws, I'm talking about decrees, I'm talking about regulations. So the Free Officers used a series of these institutions, rules, laws, decrees, in order to establish a political system that was, at its base, rigged to serve them and their allies' interests. It might sound funny, but that the uprising that began on January 25th, 2011, was an uprising against this kind of institutional architecture. Yeah, you heard all kinds of stuff. Oh, we hate Hosni Mubarak, we hate Jamal Mubarak, we hate Suzanne Mubarak, we hate all of these people, and we want to get rid of Mubarak and the Mubarak family. But really what it was a group of people, predominantly young people, which grew to hundreds of thousands. I think the apocryphal story is that it was at the end of the January 25th uprising, something like 20 million people in the streets, which allegedly on June 30th of last year, there's 30 million people in the streets. But they were rising up against this political order that was founded by the Free Officers 57 years early. That sounds totally weird. There's been four presidents of Egypt, now it's been five, four presidents of Egypt between the time that the Free Officers consolidated their power and the uprising. There have been numerous domestic policy changes, there have been numerous foreign policy changes, there have been numerous economic changes. But overall, the contours of this political system, this regime, remain that of the Free Officers. And that's because the change that has happened over the course of those six decades happened within the context of those institutions. So that you can take a press law that the Free Officers discovered in the mid-1950s to gain control over the media environment, and you can trace it all the way forward to the press law, to Mubarak's press laws, to Morsi's press laws, and will no doubt be President, Field Marshal, Commodore, Ruler of the Universe, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi's press laws. This kind of thing, by the way, when he promoted himself to Field Marshal, maybe you military guys will think this is fine. When he promoted himself to Field Marshal, I thought it was kind of funny. So I immediately took to Twitter because when I'm feeling nauseous, I immediately think of Twitter. And I promoted myself to Commodore Commander of the Oceans, which I actually got one of the more retweets than I've ever gotten before. I can have some brilliant insight about the Middle East, but it's really the snarky, obnoxious stuff that gets from tweeting many times, probably by these two guys in the front row here. But this idea that institutions kind of recreate themselves is what geeks like me call path dependencies. And essentially what we're looking at is some, well, we look 57 years, some version of the military order that was established in the mid-1950s that had a profound effect on the quality of politics in Egypt. And which, as I said before, was what people who came out to Tahrir Square, that's what they were protesting against. Now, the direction of politics, of Egyptian politics before the uprising was something that made the military very, very uncomfortable. Now I'm getting into why did they act on February 11th when they acted? Why did the officers act? The direction of politics in pre-uprising Egypt was a cause for concern for the senior command. The prospects, potential for a Gamal Mubarak presidency. Now, there is an assumption that Gamal Mubarak would be the president. No one will ever know whether he was being teed up to be the president or not. But that was the prevailing wisdom in Egypt. It was either going to be Gamal Mubarak or Omar Suleiman, the intelligence chief at the time. Although Omar Suleiman himself was a military officer, either one of them presented a problem to military. But in particular, a Gamal Mubarak presidency posed a grave challenge to the officers because it threatened to break that informal institutional linkage between the military and the presidency. As important as these kind of formal institutions of the state that condition politics, written down rules, laws, decrees, and regulations, they're just as important were informal institutions, these uncodified, unwritten norms. And one of the most important, if not the most important, uncodified, unwritten norm was that there was a direct linkage between the senior military command and the Egyptian presidency. So a Gamal Mubarak presidency would blow this whole thing up. Economic liberalization and the rise of crony capitalism, or an intensification, I should say, of crony capitalism in Egypt in the pre-uprising period also posed a challenge to the officers. And what I'm talking about here is, you know, you hear all kinds of crazy stuff in the press. Oh, the Egyptian military controls 75% of Egypt's GDP. Oh, the Egyptian military controls everything. This is wildly, wildly inaccurate. But the Egyptian armed forces does control important chunks of the Egyptian thing, from shoes to tanks, to spring water to ovens, to security services firms, to aviation services firms, to tourist interests. They are a major economic player. And the rise of crony capitalism and economic liberalization threaten at some point to touch the kinds of business interests that the military have. That's an important point to remember, that although the military doesn't control the economy in the way in which it's been popularized, they do jealously guard that part of the economy that they do control. And then I think the most important motivating factor for the military in intervening in the political system on February 11th the way they did was the threat to social cohesion that the uprising, and the particular turn of the uprising, late in the uprising, the particular threat to social cohesion and how what Mubarak did threatened the stability of the country. This is something that the Egyptian military, from the time that I began talking to them in the late 1990s all the way up to today, have emphasized, that social cohesion to them was the most important issue for them. And there seems to be this sense, and I think it's clearly just a function of the last 3 years, that this is an autonomous military establishment that has run roughshod over the political system for many years. When in fact, it's not the case. The Egyptian officer corps was able to take a low profile, have their delegate at the presidency, and remove themselves from politics precisely because the political system that their predecessors created worked. absolutely work. In my book, in Wounded But Not Governed, I have a section where I talk about, where I compare Egypt, Turkey, and Algeria. What I say is, in a counterintuitive way, the Egyptian armed forces of these three militaries is actually the strongest of the three. Now, for those of you guys who've been in the field with the Egyptian armed forces, that might sound weird. For those of you guys who may have flown with the Egyptian military and they say, oh, it's cloudy, you don't want to fly today. Or look at their F-16s in hangars and admire these hangar queens and their beauty. It may sound funny to you, but that's not what the Egyptian armed forces is about. Egyptian armed forces isn't about projecting power outside the borders of the state. It is about protecting the country, but importantly, it has been about protecting a regime that their predecessors founded and that most of all benefits them. And it worked. The system worked. The system was institutionalized and it worked. And the reason why I can come to the conclusion, the reason why I came to the conclusion that they were stronger than the Turks, stronger than the Algerians, was maybe they couldn't bring as much force to bear. Maybe they can't project power in the same way that Turkey can, that's what is it, the second largest military in NATO. But because it didn't have to intervene in politics as often. The Turkish public wasn't buying what the Turkish military was selling. They're always working to change the political order in one way or the other. In Egypt, the political system, this institutionalized military system, actually worked, which meant that the military didn't actually have to intervene in the political system until, of course, the January 25th uprising. And these three things happened. The prospect of a civilian president, they were able to resolve that problem. They were able to resolve the problem of other economic interests potentially encroaching on their own interests, and they're able to resolve the problem of social cohesion. And they intervened. Well, what was it that they wanted once they intervened? Well, I think they wanted three things once they intervened. One, they wanted to ensure those economic interests, which was the reason why they came in, but throughout that seemingly endless 18 months between Mubarak and Mohamed Morsi, they sought to ensure that afterwards their economic interests were protected. The second thing that they wanted was they wanted to get out of politics as fast as they possibly could, which I'll talk about in a second. And then the third thing they wanted was the military wanted to strike a deal with anybody. And let me emphasize that. They wanted to strike a deal with anybody because they don't actually believe in anything. They have no ideological worldview. There's no kind of motivating sense of ideas. There's no Kemalism that motivates and shapes their worldview. What they solely wanted to do was strike a deal with it. It could have been Mohamed El-Berdai. If Mohamed El-Berdai had been the one to give coherence to the uprising and a real leader of the uprising, it could have been the Muslim Brotherhood, which it was, the Muslim Brotherhood. Strike a deal with anyone in which the military would retain its position as the locus of power, prestige, and authority in the political system. Those are the three things that they wanted during that period when they held executive power in Egypt. Stepping into the political system the way they did on February 11, 2001, although they had to do it, ran against everything that the Egyptian armed forces had learned and taught themselves since their defeat in June 1967 and their redemption in October 1973. And that was that a politicized, a military that's involved in politics gets politicized, undermines the armed forces' corporate coherence, and makes it difficult for them to perform their primary mission, which is defending the country. And they had stayed out of politics and had the benefit of the fact that the political system, like I said before, their predecessors had founded, worked extremely well. They simply did not want to run the country. I went to Egypt once every 6 weeks after the uprising for a period of months until October 2011. And every time I went to the Ministry of Defense, which was every trip that I went to, I would see members of the staff and other senior officers. And every time I see them, they look more and more haggard. Every time I saw them, you got the sense that they came into the office every morning and they tore another day off of their calendar because they were counting down the days that they could
strike that deal and hand power off to someone else. And that's why. That's why, to outsiders, the sequence of the transition during this period between Mubarak and Morsi seemed crazy. It seemed absolutely nuts. It was a backwards kind of transition. When did you ever hear of a successful transition in which people voted for a parliament whose powers people had no idea because there was no constitution? Then you would slap together a constitution and then vote for a president. In 6 months, in Egypt, this was crazy. Post-apartheid South Africa took 7 years to write a constitution. This kind of odd timeline, this odd sequencing of a transition was a function of the fact that the military really did not want to be in power. Of course, they made a hash of things during the 18 months between Mubarak and Morsi, and ultimately handed the country over to the Muslim Brotherhood. As I said before, not believing in anything, they were willing to make a deal with anybody as long as it would ensure the three core interests that the military had. And then we have the Morsi interregnum. It was rather startling when, on August 12, 2012, everybody woke up to the fact that, an announcement that Field Marshal Hussein Tantawi was being retired. Lieutenant General Sami Anand, from my understanding, is very popular here in Washington and within the senior command in the U.S. military, was made an advisor to the president. I mean, this was almost worse than being sent off to the Egyptian ambassador in Norway or something like that. I mean, at least the real hero of the crossing, Lieutenant General Shazley, got sent to London. This guy got made an advisor to President Morsi. I wonder if Anand actually showed up to that. Anyway. And then the subsequent moves, they lopped off the senior rung of the command. Now, this led observers in Washington, some observers, some who should know better, some who don't, some who just want to get on television, to conclude that the Muslim Brotherhood and Mohammed Morsi had mastered the military, that this was a fundamental change in civil-military relations in Egypt. If the first civilian elected president of Egypt within a few months of taking office could retire, the field marshal who had been serving for 20 years and the chief of staff who had been serving as the chief of staff for the previous seven years, then clearly the civilians now had a mandate, and this represented a fundamental change in civil-military relations. But what people didn't recognized was that if in fact this was Morsi doing that, and I'm not convinced that it was, but if in fact it was Morsi that was doing this, he had to rely on the military to push Tantawi and this whole senior rung from the military. That he had to rely on Abdel Fattah al-Sisi and his lieutenants in order to accomplish this change in the military, which would suggest actually no change in the pattern of civil-military relations in Egypt. This clearly was not as radical a change as people make out, and July 3rd, 2013 confirmed all of that. That in fact civilians had not come to the fore, that the military remained the locus of power and authority in the political system, and that since July 3rd, this pattern has been reinforced. Now, why did the military move against Morsi?
I think there are three reasons or so.
Why? Four reasons. It wasn't because Mohamed Morsi had turned his back on the principles of the revolution. What did the military care whether Mohamed Morsi was a Democrat or an authoritarian? This was not, despite what the military wants to tell you about paving the way for Egypt's democratic future, this was not what set them on the path of coup d'etat in July 2013. And don't let anybody, any Egyptian, argue with you that it wasn't a coup. I'm sure all of you here understand that coups have civilian components as well. If If you study the history of civil-military relations, you see civilians either seek the military or the military seeks civilians in the period that run that in a period before a military undertakes a coup. There's always a civilian-military partnership. But there were some discrete reasons why, other than this, he turned his back on the principles of a revolution. First, in May of 213, he called upon Egyptians to go and undertake jihad in Syria, and that if Morsi did, and if they came back, they wouldn't face any punishment. This horrified the military. In late June, instead of giving a conciliatory speech after facing so much opposition, societal opposition, and this kind of welling up, this anticipation for big June 30 protests, he gave essentially a red meat speech to his core constituency, which threatened violence on the streets in Egypt. Of course, the huge protests of June 30th, which threatened the social cohesion of the country, in the same way that the huge protests after Mubarak's third speech on February 10th threatened the social cohesion of the country. And then, interestingly enough, wasn't just about jihad, wasn't just about threats to social cohesion, it was also about economics. Little noticed at the time was that the Muslim Brotherhood, a bunch of pretty savvy business people, were talking about redevelopment of cities along the canals. Now, the military has traditionally not been in the canal zone in ways that they wanted to, by dint of restrictions placed upon them in the peace treaty. The Sinai Peninsula has basically been a no-go zone for the military in terms of its own business activities. The military is in the canal zones, but not in the way that they are in other parts of the country. And the Muslim Brotherhood was very clearly talking about massive redevelopment that would, guess what, benefit the Muslim Brotherhood at the expense of other major economic assets. This was clearly part of the calculus that pushed the military to end Egypt's brief experiment with Islamist political power. And what we're seeing in the aftermath is not only the reinforcement of the pattern of civil-military relations, but we're seeing a version of the old political order return. It may be more brutal, in ways it's more adept than the old political order. There will be a restoration of the linkage between the presidency and the military. But there are significant dangers to Egypt, to the Egyptian armed forces, and to Field Marshal Sisi, if in fact he does run. Every day, by the way, every day, the Egyptian press is full of stories with Sisi's going to announce tomorrow, he's going to resign today, in just a few hours. He was pictured on the front page of a Mossad Young newspaper with the current interim president. They were striding together, sunglasses on, looking off to the future. Everybody saw this as a clear sign he's about to announce his presidency. I've been on the road today. Has he announced it, Adam? No? Okay. Which is too bad, because I have a piece sitting in foreign policy that once he announces all about the Sisi presidency. Anyway, there are tremendous dangers to the armed forces of the Sisi in Egypt itself as a result of that Sisi presidency. And those are things we can talk about at length Q&A. Let me just preview by saying, once again, it runs counter to everything that the military has learned over the course of the last 47 years. Even if Sisi resigns, takes off one suit and puts on another, really the only thing civilian about him will be the suit that he puts on the morning, and will inject the military into politics in ways that they have wanted to avoid over a period of time. One would think, and I'll end on this, one would think that a restoration of the old order, some version of the old order, no matter how brutal, maybe more adept, would be as difficult as it is to accept a restoration of the kind of authoritarian stability that we observed during the long Mubarak period. You know, Mubarak wasn't perfect, he was brutal, so on and so forth, but he did some important things. And he did some important things for the United States. He kept the Suez Canal open, he kept peace with Israel, and he kept his boot on the throat of Islamists and Islamist extremists. And that's why we have a strategic relationship. And that's why successive administrations in the United States supported Mubarak. He was an old soldier. He kept things the way we wanted. He was critical to a regional political order that made it relatively easier, relatively less expensive for the United States to pursue its interests in the region and achieve its interests. And one would think that, okay, Sisi, he kind of is like Mubarak. He's a little bit older than Mubarak was when Mubarak came to power, but if we get 3 decades out of this guy and he's authoritarian, okay, it's bad for the Egyptians, but it's stability, and we can recreate this order that we once had. How bad could that possibly be? And with all due respect to the officers here, this is a view that is, I think, held in the Pentagon. Let's stop arguing about military atheists and let's get on and do business with these guys. They are our friends. But here's the difference. Here's the difference. There has been no revolution in Egypt. No revolution whatsoever. I had to fight with my publisher, my second book, The Struggle for Egypt. They wanted me to call it a revolution. I wanted to call it an uprising. I lost. It's actually called a revolution. But I don't believe that it was a revolution. It doesn't meet the technical definition of a revolution. There was no revolution either. But if there was one revolutionary thing that has happened in Egypt over the course of the last few years, that is the emergence of street politics. That is the empowerment of Egyptians. That is a sense of Egyptians taking matters into their own hands and writing their own history. And that means that as Sisi or whoever seeks to reestablish what they believe to be the natural order of things, they are going to get resistance. And they're not just going to get resistance from the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood, of course, which perceives a superior political strategy of seeking to undermine this new old political order. It's best for them to do that. But also, what one could arguably, but it's a bad label, call liberals, leftists, secularists, socialist revolutionaries, who are offended by the actions of the military and its allies since the July 3rd coup. And the only answer that the leadership has in response are authoritarianism, coercion, and violence. That's the only way they now know how to establish political control. They don't have a compelling vision for the future. They don't have the money to bribe people. And there's certain evidence that this kind of rentier state strategy of buying political acquiescence doesn't actually work so well anymore. So they are forced to rely on coercion and violence. And that sets off a dynamic in which more coercion, more violence in this environment leads to more protests, more demonstration, more violence, more insurgency in the Sinai, etc., etc., etc. So instead of authoritarian stability, Egypt's future will be one of authoritarian instability. Now, that's not an argument to make that the United States should cut off aid to the Egyptian armed forces. My colleagues who make this argument quite passionately seem to miss the fact that if you cut aid to the Egyptian military, it's not going to make Egypt less unstable and more democratic. But what we should understand, we should be wide-eyed about, is that as hard as Egypt's new leadership tries to reestablish a new version of the old political order, it is going to set off a dynamic of instability, uncertainty, and periodic spasms of violence. Not for a year, not for 2 years, but for the better part of the next decade at least. This is actually the subject of my other book, The Struggle for Egypt, but we can talk about that in the Q&A. I want to apologize. I'm going to stop here. I want to apologize because I'm the worst person to sit next to at a dinner party because someone leans over and says, what do you think is going to happen with Egypt? By the time I'm done, people want to hang themselves because it's a pretty horrible situation there. Egypt is fated to be in this very uncertain, quite violent, quite radicalized political environment against the backdrop of a collapsing economy. The collapsing economy actually pre-exists this type of politics, but they now feed off of each other. And the economy, which was part of the press coverage of Egypt up until last summer has sort of fallen off the radar screen because the Saudis, the Kuwaitis, and the Emiratis immediately announced, after the coup, $12 billion in aid for the Egyptians, and recently announced another $8 billion. And you would think, okay, that's going to set the Egyptians up. I have news for you, however. The Egyptians are right back where they were in late 2012, early 2013, floating just above the critical minimum of foreign reserves that they have to pay for 3 months of wheat and fuel and other critical things that they need. And that, now that I mentioned wheat, this is the interactive part of my speech, my lecture. Does anybody know what country that's gotten a lot of attention recently is a major exporter of wheat? Ukraine. Take Ukraine offline, and you see an increase in the world price of wheat. The Egyptians already heavily subsidized bread. What happens when the world price of wheat goes up? They're going to expend more and more and more money. Egypt could go broke tomorrow. Add that to this rather surreal and violent political arena, and what we're looking at is the potential for a failed state. A failed state in which we have extraordinary, the United States has extraordinary strategic interests. I certainly hope that that doesn't happen. That is the worst case scenario. But as Egypt has fallen off the front page in the New York Times, as Anderson Cooper has moved elsewhere with his black t-shirt, that doesn't mean that we are not confronting a potential catastrophe in a country that sits on the Suez Canal, that's at peace with Israel, and that is one quarter of the Arab world. Like I said, I'm not really the best person to sit next to at a dinner party and talk about Egypt. But there you have it. And I think that civil-military relations in Egypt are not going to be what people think it's going to be. I could come back 18 months from now and give you my post-CC speech. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but I'm saying it's a real possibility. Anyway, thank you very much for taking the time today. I'm really happy to answer any questions that you might have on Egypt or any other topic on the Middle East. If I don't want to answer it, I will certainly tell you that.
Sir, I got a question. You said that if Al Mubarak were to come into power, it would break the linkage between the presidency and the military. Why exactly would that have happened? Why couldn't he just step in like his father and assume a position closest to the military and maintain that linkage?
Well, first, I think it's very unlikely that Al Mubarak would now become the president. Given the fact that he's hanging out in Tora prison with his brother. It's not so much that Kamal Mubarak couldn't come into the presidency and couldn't become close to the military and so on and so forth, but that because there was this strong connection between the military and the presidency, in fact, this institutional linkage, what you would have is a military that was more autonomous, a military that was not as low profile, a military that was more apt to be directly involved in politics, which would likely destabilize the political order, which is precisely the kinds of things that we're seeing now. My sense is that Gamal, had he become the president of Egypt, would have had to be more aggressive in seeking the support and taking care of the core interests of the armed forces that his father had, because his father came from the military and he didn't. That would have had, I think, deleterious both political and economic consequences for Egypt. I'm not saying that Gamal couldn't have become the president. In fact, towards the end of ruling by governing, I talk about what would happen should Gamal become the president. Remember, I wrote this in 2007, and so that was still a very real possibility. And I think what you would find is, as I said, a military that was more deeply and directly involved in politics than the military in Egypt had been since 1954, 54 or 55, for example. That's a bold statement, but I think, or 1967, I mean, pick your date. But it probably would have changed Egyptian politics in fundamental ways. And who knows whether he would have been there for very long. Let's assume Gamal Mubarak had become president, but his father was dead. Based on what would Gamal be able to base his power? On a bunch of corrupt businessmen who the military only had disdain for? So I think that you would have, in time, seen some sort of correction in the same way that you saw a correction after the Morsi period. Yes?
Well, thank you, because I agree with you that I think
stop there.
The institutions of the state create military is so embedded in the economy and the politics that I don't think any civil president has any opportunity to do anything but being a partner with the military and running along. But I do have a question about the military, because I don't see the Egyptian military as a cohesive, coherent organization. It's not one military. And in fact, what you have is a high-level, stratified group at the top benefiting from the economic and political activity. You have the everyday soldier. And you know, unlike the scenario in Syria, where you have a military that's got its life and future invested in keeping us out of the place, I don't think the junior members of the Egyptian military really would want to shoot on fire or something.
And that's why they didn't in January 25th, 26th, 27th.
And I think that's one of the main reasons they backed off, was not because of Mubarak and Gamal, but because they knew that they couldn't put the word. That's just my perception.
No, I think you're right on two points. One, I think, you know, when we talk about the military, it's always a shorthand for something else. And I think that you're absolutely right. You cannot talk about the military or the security establishment. You have the military, you have the senior command, you have the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, you have the Ministry of Interior, the police generals, you have the General Intelligence Services, you have a number of different actors that make up the security establishment in Egypt, and then those actors, it's actually the politics in and among those groups that are really going to shape the contours of Egypt post-Mubarak. I think that's absolutely right. I think also that it's not... this is where I agree and differ with you at all the same time, which is, I'm a social scientist, so I get to do that, right? I agree with you that the concern about Gamal was one thing. And I agree with you that the military was never going to shoot its own people, although they really haven't demonstrated, let's say, a lot of restraint since July 3rd. I mean, that whole myth that we'll never shoot Egyptians is, can you say bullshit here for a person? Sorry, do I have to get my coin back? Okay. But you're right in the fact that unlike the Syrian military, the Egyptian armed forces is not tied to a specific person, leader, clan, tribe, religious group, or what have you. But that can be autonomous unto itself. And a political actor, if not the political actor, that represents the locus, the power, authority, and prestige in the political system. That's why Mubarak was dispensable. He had put their whole thing in jeopardy. The whole system was now in jeopardy as the stupid decisions that Hosni Mubarak made. So they could get rid of him and then go about trying to salvage what they can of the political system so that they can continue to benefit and continue to be the locus of authority and power in the system. That's how Egypt was able to, as awful as Egypt has ended up, that's how Egypt has ended up where it is and where Syria has ended up where it is. And I think, you know, a lot of Egyptians, you know, they're talking about the military as an institution. I think they thank God every day that it did end up that way, because Syria is obviously a case that no one would want to replicate. So, question over here. Sir?
I have two questions. One looking back.
There's one question in two parts.
No, it's two parts.
Oh, okay.
You make it very strong, I think, absolutely. valid case for extraordinary continuity between three officers who in 2011. By implication, it appears that you think there was profound change as a result of the three officers coup. And that is different than the impression that I had. Looking towards the future, rather than past, you constructed a possible scenario for a failed regency, a failed state. Can you construct a positive scenario?
Two things. One, I do think that there was the July 1953 coup and then the 18 months between the coup and the free officers' consolidation of power. There was what we would call a punctuating equilibrium, where the country was on a particular trajectory, and as a result of the free officers' coup and their consolidation of power, Egypt went in another direction. I mean, we can play out the counterfactuals of what would have happened had there not been a coup. But it strikes me that there was a fundamental difference. And in fact, Nasser himself said in an interview in 1953 with an Italian newspaper, said, "We are no longer interested in reform. We are interested in a new regime. This is a revolution." Can I paint a positive picture of Egypt as a result of what's happened in July 2013 in this period? It's awfully hard for me because I'm the glasses half empty guy all the time. But one could, and I don't know whether this is analytically sound or not. I don't think it, but Egyptians will fulfill the roadmap that was put in place after the coup. They've affirmed the referendum by 98%. They will hold parliamentary elections. They will hold presidential elections. The presidential elections and not parliamentary elections. And then they will declare that the second revolution is complete and Egypt is firmly on the road of democracy. And one could believe that if they want. And as a result of the stability gained by implementing the roadmap, foreign direct investment will come back, there'll be gas, the tourists will come back, and the Israelis will start selling the Egyptians their gas back through the Arish National Pipeline, and everything will be okay, and Egypt will enjoy growth rates of 7% like it did in 2005, 2006, 2007. Those problem with that scenario, however, at every step of the way, there's a problem with that scenario. Most of which is it does not track with the reality as we know what is actually happening in Egypt, in which this roadmap is contested. The support for Sisi is softer than people think. That there is a full-blown insurgency in the Sinai Peninsula. That a major political force in the country, no matter how much the state-controlled media and state-friendly media wants to tell you, remains important and prestigious, and its superior political strategy is to continue to try to undermine and delegitimize the new political order. The fact that investors aren't coming back to Egypt, the fact that tourists are not coming back to Egypt, the fact that Egypt's energy infrastructure probably couldn't even handle the reverse flow of gas at this point from Israel to Egypt. All of those things would suggest that as much as everybody would like to have the positive scenario, it doesn't, as I said, conform to the facts as we know the war was really happening. When I say the support for Sisi is not as strong as people make it out to be, there was this referendum on January 14th and 15th on the new constitution. They got 98% of the vote. Wow, that's pretty awesome. 98% of the vote. Not quite the 99% that Bashar al-Assad will get in the next presidential election, but 98% is still pretty good. And 38% or 38.9% maybe out of that, 38.9% of the people who voted, who were eligible to vote, actually voted. This was seen as sort of a referendum on Assisi. Now, 38.9% of people voting is a lot better than people who voted in Mubarak's election. But it's still not the kind of political consensus that the state media and state-friendly media would like you to have. Look, if Assisi was as wildly popular as
SCC sandwiches, SCC chocolates, SCC pajamas, SCC posters, SCC this, SCC that, then you wouldn't need all this. You wouldn't need the cult of personality. You wouldn't need to be throwing people in jail for just questioning the political board. Forget Muslim Brothers. Liberal activists is a dirty word in Egypt anyway. So you don't need to throw them in jail. They're meaningless. They're like gnats if you're Field Marshal SCC. But clearly, the new leadership is worried, and these are the best evidence that they're worried. The fact that you can get SCC chocolates, and that his skin is golden, and his eyes are piercing, and people want his watch and his glasses and things like that.
So by considering a positive case, you've made a negative case.
There's a reason why my wife bought me a t-shirt that says glass half full, because she's worried that I'm always going to that darkness.
I think some people think the glass half full is obvious. But in any case, your comments suggest that at the moment, the Muslim Brotherhood are still really the only people in Egypt who have a positive political vision. Their ideas or no ideas.
That's not true. The astonishing irony of the uprising in Egypt was the triumph of liberal ideas at the expense of liberals. So, if you look at pre-uprising, the National Democratic Party, this is the Mubarak Party, which was neither national nor democratic nor much of a party, had since 2004 appropriated the language of political reform and change and liberalism and so on and so forth to advance an inherently anti-democratic agenda, which was to institutionalize the power of the NDP, which was actually rather weak. It was just by dint of the NDP's patronage, and there really being no other choice, that it was in the position of power that it was in. At around the same time, the Muslim Brotherhood, well, actually even earlier, if you look at the Muslim Brotherhood's electoral platforms from the 1980s, they had appropriated these ideas of political change, liberal ideas, and so on and so forth, but had never actually repudiated what their ultimate goals were. And this was NDP leaders, Brotherhood leaders, Nasserists, leftists, everybody understood that these ideas were deeply, deeply appealing to your average Egyptian. Whether they really internalized the idea of democracy, whether they really understood democracy the way that we understand it, that's not a cultural argument, it's just saying that maybe they understood it in a different way. But that is deeply appealing in the way in which to garner following is, one of the ways is to offer these kinds of ideas. Yet, when it came time, the Brotherhood, which everybody believed had a vision, had a positive vision, they failed. They failed. I don't think that any of the political actors in Egypt have that positive vision for the future, and that's my diagnosis of the problem in Egypt. It's not necessarily civil-military relations. It is the lack, and this is the subject of my book, The Struggle for Egypt, it is that lack of an appeal. Deeply appealing vision for the future. For arguably between 1955 and 1967, Nasserism had, because the gap between the principles of Nasserism and the objective reality of your average Egyptian was relatively small. From that time on, it grew and grew and grew and grew. No one has an answer to that now. No one can answer the questions that Egyptians have been asking themselves about demanding representative government, social justice, economic development, national dignity. Nobody has a vision that encompasses all those things that makes the most sense to the vast majority of Egyptians. So what you're left with are people seeking to impose their political will on the other, and those that happen to hold power at the moment using force and coercion in the breach to establish political control. And that's how you have this political ferment and this instability and this uncertainty that I think is going to last for some time. That's crazy. In that,
So you talk about, I think you talk about the strategic interest of Egypt to the United States, and you talk about the cost of the government subsidizing food and the survival of the Egyptian people. What do you think realistically the U.S. could be doing? Would it help us to export more F-16s over there? Is that going to really help them out? Or?
No, it's going to help out the fine citizens of Fort Worth, Texas, from what I understand. And my neighbors in Montgomery County, who are the executives of McDonnell Douglas. But I guess their stock option will be worth more than more F-16s that we sent to Egypt. Although, I'm not... What should we do? It's a difficult question. First, I do think we should be sending F-16s and Apaches and M1A1 tanks to the Egyptian forces. I mean, why not? Why not? It benefits us. And if it means that we're going to reassure the Egyptian senior command that we stand with them in their fight against terrorism, I think that that's a good thing. Because what it does is what the Egyptian military wants, they want to be reassured by us. And when we go in there, we say, look, you guys need to change your doctrine to meet 21st century threats. What are you doing? Look at this insurgency you've got going in the Sinai and so on. So they say, wait, you're not going to give us the tanks and the planes? You just want to make us a gendarmerie? My answer to that is, let's reassure them. Let's give them the $1.3 billion, let's give them the planes, let's give them the Apaches. And maybe they'll be more amenable, because they're feeling reassured, to take our advice on how to actually fight an insurgency. They don't trust us because we're delaying delivery of four F-16s and 15 Apaches. What they don't understand is that these kinds of things is the Obama administration calibrating very carefully. How can we, for Washington politics reasons, and to get the Washington Post off of our backs, send a signal that we disapprove of the coup of July 3rd, 2013, sort of, kind of. I mean, there are no real fans of Mohamed Morsi in Washington, D.C. Well, I can name a few. And without harming the Egyptian armed forces, they don't get that. They only see the delay of delivery of equipment that they purchased in 2010 and 2011. Rather than, look, they did these things because they had to do it, but they did it so they didn't really hurt your ability to fight in Sinai. They're so concerned that we are walking away from them, that we are trying to turn them into a gendarmerie, that they're not really a strategic partner any longer in the United States. I mean, things that are innocuous that we've done get twisted in the kind of unsettled politics in Egypt. To the Obama administration, sending Ambassador Ann Patterson to Egypt was a great idea. She had been in Pakistan, she had dealt with military leaders in difficult situations, so on and so forth. This was perfect. She had some experience dealing with military-dominated governments and histories of military governments. Egyptians, I remember Egyptians looking at me in the Ministry of Defense and saying, they think we're Pakistan? How can they think we're Pakistan? So it's very, very difficult. And I think that we have to reassure the Egyptian military in one sense that we stand with them while helping them change their doctrine. Now, what should we do in terms of economic collapse and so on and so forth?
Right. Well, how does that help the gas line? The gas line.
It doesn't. That doesn't help the gas line.
It doesn't bring hollow at the end of the day when that's the American perspective. Oh, we see the price of wheat, you can't even buy it, you can't afford meat more than once a week. You've got gas lines and...
Well, it's not you know,
people selling hookah pipes and gas lines because the gas lines are so long and we're sending up 16.
It's not either or.
Right.
It's not either or. So we should do that one thing, yet at the same time, because of our own politics, it's difficult for us to muster the kind of resources necessary to help the Egyptians. You know, we had to fight over sending $250 million to Egypt because of a variety of political problems that we have here in the United States, which is why the Egyptians are now flirting with the Russians. But your question is, what is it that we can do? It's not, of course, we can do all kinds of things. We can use our diplomatic clout with this country and that country and a whole consortium of countries to help the Egyptians on the economy. But the Egyptians have to be able to do it themselves also. You are looking at an array of incoherent economic policies that have no economic rationale but have political rationale. And that's why you have gas lines. But because of the experience of the 1977 bread riots and the homeless bread riots of 2008, no one is really willing to take those steps in order to fundamentally alter a series of economic policies that, as I said, have a political rationale, combined with, that makes it worse because you have more and more unemployed, more and more young unemployed. It makes it practically impossible for them to do it. We could, of course, go to our Emirati, Saudi, and Kuwaiti partners and say, look, we need some sort of coherence to what we're doing in Egypt. But given the fact that we don't see eye to eye with our Gulf allies on a variety of issues, it's really unlikely that we're going to get the Saudis to condition the money that they're pouring into Egypt. So no matter really what we do, Egyptians are going to still have gas lines. There's $20 billion Gulf dollars, including direct transfer of energy resources from the Gulf, for nothing, for zero. Just here it is. And the Egyptians still have gas lines. That's not a function of American policy. That's a function of Egyptian policy. I think that it's going to have to start in Cairo before we do anything. My fear is it's not going to happen in Cairo because it's too difficult politically. And it's going to be too late. Remember what I said. $20 billion later, the Egyptians are just barely above that critical minimum line. And they can go broke tomorrow. I'm not sure that copious amounts of aid is going to do anything. And that's why I said when I was closing my remarks, I could come back here next year or a year and a half from now and give you my post-season speech. And I think really the only thing that he has going for him is, if in fact he has a lot of prestige, he has a few more months to deal with what is likely to be a disastrous economic situation.
How do you interpret the generational transition in Egyptian America?
This is a really interesting question, because ever since I started my research on militaries in the Middle East in the late 1990s, everybody's been saying to me, wait for that generation shift. Then you'll see. A lot of these guys have been trained in the United States and so on, have a different worldview and so on and so forth. Well, arguably, the Sisi is a product of American military education. Certainly his predecessors weren't. The chief of staff also, people went through the Army War College. Some of these young military officers who are on Twitter have a very interesting perspective. I would not say that they are strong advocates of representative democracy and pluralism. I would say that they have been socialized, despite whatever American military education they've gotten, whatever they've earned through the IMED program or whatever, still calculate their interests, the future, in a way that their military education in Egypt has been decisive. And that this idea of the military as an elite, vanguard, the most organized, technologically equipped group, and a profound disdain for civilians and civilian politics carries on from one generation to the next. It's funny, when arguably Morsi dumped Kantawi and Annan, like I said, not without the help of Assisi, everybody thought that Assisi would take a more humble tone, that the military's rightful place was behind the scenes, and that and Kantawi had taken the military in the wrong direction. Subsequent to that, we've all learned really what Assisi's problem was, that these guys weren't tough enough in the political system. They weren't tough enough in arranging the political environment in a way that would benefit the military out into the future. That they were too willing to negotiate with civilian politicians who were going to make a hash of things. And rather, this younger group of officers has been, and senior officers, have been wanting to be much tougher in with the civilian politicians and in future and setting up the future trajectory of Egypt. I don't see, and I could be wrong, but I don't see a kind of flowering of liberal, democratic, pluralist thought among a younger generation of officers. It just doesn't seem to me to be realistic what I know of them. And now, of course, the generation of officers that I dealt with the most over the course of 10 are being retired, and they're leaving, and so on and so forth. So we're interested in something new, but my contacts...
I'm doing my PhD dissertation on
this generational change.
Yeah.
And it'll be very, very interesting. I'm eager to read it, but my contacts within the military and have said, this is a group of officers that are different from the officers that you've come to know over the course of the last 15 years. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they've embraced democracy. I always thought that was really, really interesting, that people automatically assume that a younger generation that had been educated, not completely, but more educated in the West, was somehow going to be more democratic. It's sort of like the assumptions about Bashar al-Assad. He lived in London, he had a hot wife, and he surfed the internet. If so, back when he was a reformist. You know, it's the same kind of thing. I guess I should have said in a very pretty way. I apologize. It's the new Marine Corps. Anyway, other questions? We can't end on hot wife, please. Neither the Shah or nor us and Mubarak embraced our ideals or our values. They shared our interests, and therefore we determined they were deserving of our virtually unconditional support. If your question is, because they were the beneficiaries of our unconditional support for many years, why did the United States then subsequently walk away from them? That's a different story. And I think that I plead ignorance on Afghanistan because what I know about Afghanistan, I read in the New York Times, and I can never trust anything other than newspapers, but although they have very talented journalists, I just know from my own experience of working on military and reading about military in the newspapers, in Mubarak's case, which is the one that I know better, I was in Congress the first 4 days of the uprising. It was pretty clear to me within the first 48 hours that Mubarak was done. There was nothing that was going to rescue him. Whether President Obama stood up and said, Hosni Mubarak is my best friend, and said, it's okay if the Egyptian armed forces drops a bomb in Tahrir Square, or President Obama stood up and said, Hosni Mubarak is a big jerk and we hate him, the outcome was going to be the same. Because Egyptians were, as I said before, taking matters into their own hand, writing their own history. It was over very, very quickly. What was left was, what was the modality by which he was was this going to be a dignified exit, or was it not? And that's what the military was seeking. They were seeking a dignified exit. They did not want to set the precedent of a soft coup, but they did. The United States was also seeking a dignified exit. Mubarak and his family were defiant, and that's how you got ultimately what you got. Too often, I think, you know, Americans aren't imperialists, but Washington, D.C. is sort of an imperial city. We somehow think that we can, you know, change the world and things are up to us. And, you know, you talk to members of Congress, they say, we're the American Congress, you know, and it doesn't work that way. And what really has been happening in Egypt with regard to American policy is we're responding to outcomes that are of the Egyptians' making. That's not to say that we don't have any influence left in the world and that we should disengage the world, but that the stakes in a country like Egypt, and I should add a country like Syria, a country like Turkey, in the Arab-Israeli conflict, that the stakes are so high for these people. I mean, people in Egypt have defined this as a battle for the heart and soul of the country, that as a result, they're making their decisions, they're seeing their political incentives and their disincentives based on local conditions, based on what's happening on the street, not what the President of the United States or the Secretary of State or the Secretary of Defense or the Commandant of the Marine Corps are saying. And that's, I think, a reality in the Middle East that we're going to have to accept for the better part of the next decade. That maybe the best policy for the United States is not to, you know, airdrop State Department employees with Middle East Partnership Initiative grant applications into Tahrir Square, but maybe it's to step back and let people who are engaged in what they believe to be existential struggles of the heart and soul of their countries to work these issues out on their own. And when they ask for our help, provide the help the best that we can and as long as it's consistent with our values and our interests. But we can't be remaking these countries. It wasn't up to us whether Hosni Mubarak stayed or not. It wasn't up to President Carter whether the Shah of Iran went or not. It's not that we don't have any influence, but in these environments, it's harder and harder to see where we can have the influence. And back to this gentleman's question, maybe one of the things is that we can do things on the security front. We can help it, as much as we may dislike what the Egyptian armed forces has done in terms of arresting activists, killing people, and so on and so forth, they do very much confront a very significant insurgency in the Sinai that does touch on our core national security interests, and at least we can have an impact there in helping them fight that insurgency. But in terms of the political trajectory of the country, I don't think we have as much influence as we like to believe that we are. And I think whatever aid that we give is a particularly bad tool in terms of shaping people's behavior in these environments.
So I can ask one more question. One follow-up.
Well, last question, okay.
Given what you just said there, and you already said you're a half-glass full kind of guy, so...
My wife had to get me the half-full t-shirt to get me the positive.
I can probably drag no shortage of Egyptians on the stage who would say that it was a revolution, it was their revolution, and don't listen to American pundits and social scientists who can tell you otherwise. So given how what you just said in the ownership that Egyptians have of their country, how do we understand that this isn't a revolution, that this was not just the military helping out the civilian population and it was the will of the civilians?
I could be wrong.
Yes.
But I would suggest that however many months are we past the coup, 6-7 months after the coup, there are less and less people who are willing to, less and less Egyptians who are willing to scratch my eyes out when I say that it's a coup than there were people who were willing to scratch my eyes out when I said it was a coup on July 4th. I would say that more and more people are recognizing exactly what's happening in Egypt. That you don't have to be, in certain circles, you have to be careful about calling it a coup. My friends in the military will read something I wrote, I'll call it a coup, and I'll get this nasty email. You know it wasn't a coup. But I think more and more people recognize exactly
what certainly people are disillusioned, and certainly the military gained mythic proportions along the way, and the way forward is very unclear. I don't know. I'm not sure how that redefines, and who gets to define, you know,
that's the problem. That's the challenge in Egypt right now.
Yeah.
Who gets to define Egypt? Everybody wants to focus on economic issues, on politics, and so on and so forth. It's about, and I'm not selling the book, but in the struggle for Egypt, that is, I trace Egyptian politics from the 1880s up until July 2011 in terms of identity. That the struggle for Egypt is about its identity, and that until someone, some political entrepreneur comes to the fore and answers these questions about, key questions about identity, about what are the organizing principles of government? What is the relationship between religion and society? What's the relationship between the individual and society? What does it mean to be Egyptian? What does Egypt mean? Until someone can answer those questions, you're going to have this kind of political ferment and instability. I think that, you know, collapsing economy and whether Sisi becomes the president or not are really, in the grand scheme of what is actually happening in this 150 or whatever, how bad that year arc of Egyptian political history, those things are seem incredibly important at this moment, and, you know, feed the machine. But really, it's this larger issue about Egypt's identity. To be sure, Egypt is, and you hear this all the time, it is one of the few actual states in the region has weighed as historical and so on. But that does not mean that there aren't these struggles over what it means to actually be Egyptian. And that, to my mind, is the central, it's not the only, but the central issue in this whole story, and the story that's been accentuated over the course of the last 3 years, is one that you go back to the late 19th century and all through the 20th century, you see it playing out in different ways and different forms. And that's why when I was in Tahrir Square, I tweeted that Egyptians have been in revolt against the people who have ruled them in different ways for the better part of the last century. It seemed to me this was part of, you know, the 1919 Nationalist Revolution is inherently connected to the January 25th uprising, which is connected to the July 3rd coup, which is connected to the 1968 uprising, and so on and on and on and on. You can make all these really interesting connections. It's all part of one big story that I call the struggle for Egypt. Are we done?